From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we revisit our coverage of the unrest and protests this summer over police violence. We'll hear from two witnesses to the deadly shooting at a protest in Kenosha. Then we'll learn how Wisconsin's open carry laws create complications for both protesters and law enforcement.
Under Wisconsin law, officers only need probable cause to believe that a person has committed a crime. But the practical consideration by law enforcement is if we do arrest people, you know, whether the charge is strong or weak, might we be throwing more fuel on the fire, so to speak.
Plus, we look at the history of Milwaukee protests and what can be learned from the past.
The trouble was when the violence ended, there was a sense of victory, of order over chaos, rather than a wake-up call that something was seriously wrong.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This year will go down in history for so many reasons. The entire world battled the COVID-19 pandemic, protests erupted over racial injustice, and the U.S. elected a new president. The demonstrations began in late May after the killing of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis. In August, Kenosha police were captured on camera shooting a man named Jacob Blake in the back, which sparked unrest there. It was during one of those demonstrations that Kyle Rittenhouse opened fire on protesters, killing two people. Rittenhouse is facing homicide charges but is out of jail on $2 million bail. Kenosha natives Chelsea Dominguez and her boyfriend TJ Williams witnessed part of the deadly shooting and spoke to Lake Effect's Joy Powers about what happened that night back in August.
Why did you decide to initially join these protests?
After seeing the video, I just felt that we needed to get out there and see what was going on. We wanted to, you know, show our support in thinking that Jacob Blake was shot unjustifiably by the Kenosha Police Department. We don't think that they immediately handled the situation very well. So we felt like we needed to be there.
TJ, a lot of the reason that you're there is to really document what's been going on. Why did you decide to do that?
Sure. So the first night, it was Sunday night after Jacob Blake was shot by the police officer. That night, we were watching videos from Corey Elijah, who's a popular live streamer in the area. But it was hard to continue to watch his video as things were starting to get pretty heated at the police station and the courthouse. The videos, you could see the live viewers were at 15,000 and they kept getting cut down to 3,000 all of a sudden. So people kept losing connection. I'm not sure if they had signal jammers out there or whatnot, but it definitely seemed like it. And we both made the decision that we should go down there ourselves and document. We should also be videoing and getting as much as possible for people to see, because if there's only one or two people doing it, it's a lot easier for people to say this or that or skew the story. But if you have 10, 15 video accounts, I think it's much better. So that was our number one reason for starting to go down there.
In general, how would you describe your experiences with these protests?
In general, with the protests, it's very peaceful.
I think the majority of people coming out just, you know, want justice. We want people to start being treated fairly. So it's been widely peaceful. There are a lot of angry people, but I think that's totally fair considering what happened in our city. I think we should be angry.
I feel their pain because of the position that I'm in, being a person of color. I understand what it feels like. But as a whole, the protests have been, I don't know how else to say it, but they've been, for the most part, peaceful. After the fact, when things start to get late, there's other people that come in that weren't exactly a part of the protest. The group gets so big that you're not sure who all was here for our march, who all was here for our peaceful march or protest around town.
Being out at night, I think especially after what happened on Tuesday, a lot of people have said it's a little frightening, at least from the outside. What does it feel like on the inside?
I'd say it's certainly frightening there as well.
It was a very weird scene on Tuesday. I was recording the whole time, and looking through my video, there were times where I even said around, you know, the armed guys, like, I feel safe. I don't feel like anything's going to happen here. There's a lot of people. This doesn't really bother me. But I guess the thing that makes me feel the most unsafe is the way that our police department has been handling the crowds and the violence that happened. That's the most terrifying thing to me.
What about that have you found terrifying?
I mean, we've been tear gassed multiple times. I assume it's tear gas. I don't know. Pepper balls. We've almost been hit with rubber bullets. And that scene on Tuesday could have completely been avoided if our police department didn't continuously push us south on Sheridan Road toward those armed men. There are videos that have surfaced of those guys saying our police department said they planned on pushing us down towards the armed guards so they could take care of them and the police department could leave. And I also have that on video of once altercations did start at the gas station, where armored vehicles just turned around and went back towards the courthouse.
So once you started to approach these armed, people have been calling them militias, the police then turned around?
For some of the time. So they continued to push us south on Sheridan, which is where the courthouse is, which is where there was an auto shop that one of the militia groups was at right before 60th. And then on 60th, there's a gas station where there was also a huge, huge group of them. So they pushed us towards those guys. And then at one point, actually, the victim who was shot in the head got in an altercation because one of the militia members had pointed a gun at him and he justifiably got angry about it. And when that started happening, the armored vehicles just turned around and left. Like, they had to have seen the issue happening. They had to have seen it, the crowd that was, like, scuffling, and they just turned around.
Well, and you were both there Tuesday night when things were getting pretty bad and as things got bad. Can you explain the moments leading up to that fatal shooting?
I mean, right before it happened, everything actually seemed fairly calm. The crowd wasn't super loud. There wasn't that much action going on. But before that, you know, exchanges between the police and some of the protesters, they were firing tear gas, rubber bullets and stuff. And that was really, you know, the action of the night before the shooting. There was an incident between the victim that was later shot in the head and some of the armed militia members, but it didn't escalate violently at all, really. It was all just words. Honestly, we weren't expecting that turn.
Now, you'd seen both the victim and the shooter before this happened. Can you describe that at all? What were your interactions like with them?
Sure. So when, like Chelsea said, when we were being pushed down Sheridan South towards the car dealership and the gas station that were being protected by the armed men, when we came up on Kyle Rittenhouse, I believe his name is, when we came up on him, the first thing he said was, "Does anybody need medical? Does anybody have any injuries? If you're hurt, please come to me. I'm a medic."
Yeah, he just kept saying he was an EMT.
Exactly. He kept reiterating the fact that he was there to help. As we went past the car lot, which is kind of kitty corner from the gas station, we got up towards the gas station, and that's where the armed men and a couple other protesters started to get a little heated. The arguments came, I believe they started because one of the armed men possibly aimed his gun at the first victim. And I believe the first victim, he got very angry about that. And it just kind of was a little bit of a scuffle, kind of a pushing, shoving match, I guess you could say. And I don't believe Kyle Rittenhouse was there for that. He was not a part of this interaction at the gas station.
No, he was not there. He was still up the street at the, I don't know if it's a car dealership or an like auto body shop, but
yeah,
he wasn't at the gas station at that moment.
Exactly, a used car lot or something like that. So he wasn't a part of that moment. And I would say about, I think it was 30 or 40 minutes later, after the police were still kind of pushing us and moving us back, that's when the crowd started to disperse, but the crowd started to disperse even further south on Sheridan, making the crowd very spread out. So we were spread out amongst 2 to 3 blocks, it seemed like. And that's when they were further ahead of us. I'm not exactly sure what they were doing, but leading up to that, we continued to walk down the road, and that's when we heard gunshots, the first flurry of shots, I believe, when the first victim was shot in the head. And then we continued down the street to see what was happening. Everyone was kind of headed that way. And then that's when we saw Kyle jogging down the road with his gun. There was a few people behind him, but it looked like they were all running together. To be honest, I was still clueless at this point as to who the shooter was, because we were halfway down, you know, the block. And that's when he tripped over his own feet. We heard the gun hit the ground. He kind of rolled over. And as soon as I heard the first 2 shots that I believe missed someone, that's when I just took off.
So you saw him, after he tripped, grab his gun and start shooting?
Yeah, after he tripped, he basically started shooting as soon as he could roll over.
As soon as he got up, it wasn't about if someone's attacking me or not. It was just, he was firing.
Thank you for sharing that with me. I can't imagine how traumatic an experience that is. How are you both feeling right now in light of what's happened?
I think right now we're still trying to process it. We're trying to just get the word out about what really happened, what we witnessed. And I don't think we've really started to emotionally process it yet. Neither of us have really gotten emotional, but I think eventually that will probably come.
Yeah. Now, I want to take a bit of a step back. You grew up in Kenosha. Would you describe Kenosha as a community that has a history with issues of racial inequality, of racial injustice?
Yeah, definitely. I definitely feel that way. I would say that if you're an average middle-class citizen, maybe you don't feel that way. But I mean, just the fact that, you know, we have areas that citizens often refer to as the ghetto. And of course, you know, those are areas where it's all minorities. And all you have to do is look around those areas and see that they obviously aren't being really taken care of by the government.
I mean, it happens in any city that has, you know, 100,000 people, which Kenosha has. You start to see the racial inequalities in terms of housing, schools, where people are located in the neighborhoods. It's almost like they're put there on purpose. The jobs that they're offered, the health care that's around them, just, you know, certain things that are in their specific communities. You can tell there's a much bigger difference than if you are not a person of color. So I would say there definitely has been some issues in Kenosha in the past, but I would say I wouldn't say it's known for that. It's not a city that's known for that.
You know, with that in mind, I grew up pretty near Kenosha, and of course, you don't expect to hear Kenosha on the news that much. To hear the city being used as a kind of mononym for racial injustice or racial unrest in these protests, how does that make you feel as someone who is from Kenosha? What is your view of this kind of coverage?
I'd say, yeah, definitely. It feels weird, but I think that it's an issue that has been boiling for a very, very, very long time. I mean, we've seen it all over the country, in Minneapolis and Portland, and, you know, civil unrest everywhere where somebody is shot by the police. So even though it feels really weird, I think it only feels that way because it's here in home, and we didn't ever think that, you know, it could happen here. But of course it could. Of course.
I think it's kind of insane to be from the city that just hit international news and has sparked yet another huge line of protest. I'm not sure where, you know, when it's going to stop. The fact that it is Kenosha, I guess it didn't really surprise me as much as other people. To be from the city, you understand that the police and people of color have had issues in the past. So for something to happen like that, for him to use excessive force in my eyes, is not all that surprising. But yes, it is quite shocking to see that our town, Kenosha, Wisconsin, be in the spotlight for this type of activity.
Yeah. What do you think about this moment that the city is experiencing? And what do you hope will come out of this?
I mean, the way I feel about it, I've just been trying to tell people, you know, civil unrest is just a symptom of the way our system has been built. The people are fed up. We don't want to be treated like animals or less than human anymore. So I think what has happened to our city is a tragedy. I think it's sad that buildings have been burned. People have lost their homes and businesses. I think that's extremely sad. But at the same time, we knew that this was an issue. We just didn't think it would hit this close to home. So I'm hoping that it'll just open people's eyes to see that this can happen anywhere. This is an issue that affects everybody, and we all need to get out there and put pressure on our government to start treating people the way that we should be treated, which is just with decency, humanity, compassion, empathy. So I hope that's what happens, but I think we have a really long road ahead of us.
Chelsea Dominguez and TJ Williams are both Kenosha natives who witnessed the deadly shooting during protests in August. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Coming up, we break down Wisconsin's open carry law and examine when openly carrying a gun can turn into disorderly conduct. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Kyle Rittenhouse is accused of shooting and killing two people during a protest in Kenosha this summer. He was released from custody last week after his $2 million bail was paid with help from donations. Rittenhouse was one of several people openly carrying firearms during the protests in Kenosha over the police shooting of Jacob Blake in August. Openly carrying firearms is not illegal in Wisconsin. But doing so during a protest after a curfew is put in place brings up a lot of questions and legal concerns. Tony Cotton is an attorney in Waukesha. He helped break down what's legal when it comes to open carry laws in Wisconsin, when police can intervene, and how this issue intersects with people's First Amendment right to protest. Let's start with the basics. What is Wisconsin's law when it comes to carrying weapons?
Wisconsin is an open carry state. So under Wisconsin law, people who are 18 years or older are permitted to carry weapons in a visible fashion. Wisconsin also has what are called CCW laws, concealed carry laws, which are separate and distinct from the open carry laws. A concealed carry permit can be obtained by someone. And if a person has a CCW permit, then they can carry a firearm in a concealed manner.
And to open carry, you also need to be at least 18 years old, correct?
Correct. You have to be at least 18 years old. And of course, you can't have any of the other prohibitions that would prevent you from possessing a firearm, like being a felon or somebody who's convicted of domestic violence and things like that.
Cities and counties cannot make laws on gun possession that would then conflict with the state's open carry laws. So do things like declarations of curfews, for example, like we've seen with protest, or state emergency orders overrule or have any impact on this?
They don't overrule the state open carry rules as they exist or laws as they exist. Does it have an impact? I suppose that it could have an impact if individuals respect the curfew order that's in place. But if people don't respect that order and they're outside, that person may be violating the curfew order. But if that person has a open possession of a firearm, that person would not be running into any conflict with state law for possessing that firearm, you know, just because there's a curfew order in place.
when people are open carrying during protests, whether they're with the protesters or anti-protesters, what, if anything, could police do to intervene when someone is openly carrying a weapon? And we'll stick to Wisconsin here, obviously. You know, especially during circumstances such as this, when there are protests and curfews and things are heightened and you have someone open carrying, even though it is legal, when can police step in?
Well, yeah, I've been a lawyer for 15 or 16 years now. And I remember when I first started practicing, the question was always, it was sort of an unresolved question in Wisconsin. Candidly, it seemed very clear that you could open carry, but it really was an unresolved issue. There was, people would not do it. People certainly, if they did do it, were being arrested and charged with disorderly conduct. It was happening all the time. And 2010 or so, somewhere around there, 2011, they had that changed. And the rule basically became, or the law basically became, that if you possessed a firearm and were open carrying and not doing anything else, it wasn't a problem. What the police could choose to do in these circumstances is, when people are part of a group, if the group is peaceful, protesting peacefully, not looting businesses, not burning things to the ground, if people are just walking around with firearms, it would be really hard for law enforcement to justify an arrest of somebody who is simply just walking around with a firearm. You know, but that's not what we were seeing in Kenosha. What we were seeing is a very high level of violence, at least as I understand it, by some of the protesters. And if those people are affiliated with groups or individuals who are open carrying, it wouldn't surprise me to see law enforcement arrest those people for disorderly conduct while armed.
Right, because of that law passed in 2011, police have to prove that there is a criminal or malicious intent behind it, right?
Right. So, you know, if the group, so to speak, I'll just say the group, you know, if a group of people are looting or burning a building to the ground, and somebody that is even tangentially connected to that group has a gun in an open carry state, law enforcement certainly could arrest that person. Whether the charges would hold up, that's a totally different story. You know, it's a very low bar to arrest someone under Wisconsin law. Officers only need probable cause to believe that a person has committed a crime. So it's a low bar. But the practical consideration by law enforcement is, if we do arrest people, you know, whether the charge is strong or weak, might we be throwing more fuel on the fire, so to speak?
You know, I imagine tensions are high and you add someone open carrying, no matter how uncomfortable people may be, do you think, because of factors such as this, that things really need to escalate before police would weigh that risk and step in?
Yeah, well, we saw, unfortunately, in Kenosha, I think that, I don't know the full story, and the full story matters in every circumstance, but you know, clearly the police were not enforcing that curfew order, and it seems that one or more people were walking around with firearms, and those individuals were not being arrested, either for disorderly conduct while armed or for violating a curfew order that was lawfully passed.
So we have seen people openly carry during protests before. It's not just been here in Kenosha. It's also happened in Milwaukee. So if there is a protester or observer, you know, who sees someone open carrying and they're made uncomfortable by that, is there really anything they can do?
I think the best thing they can do is just get away, because I think people who are joining protest movements and are openly carrying firearms are, I don't see that as a tactic that's going to reduce tension. And you know, then from a legal perspective, you also have the concerns of party to a crime liability. So if you are near somebody who's possessing a firearm and you're part of that group and you're part of the protest, might an aggressive prosecutor or a police officer, if they did choose to conduct mass arrests, might they argue that you're a party to that crime in some fashion? Is also a concern that people should be mindful of. I live in Wauwatosa, right on the border of Milwaukee. And so we see protests all the time, and there's protests that literally, one of my offices is on North Avenue in Milwaukee. We've had hundreds of people protesting up and down North Avenue, shutting down traffic. A few weeks ago, I marched with a group just as a sign of support for the Black Lives Matter movement. And when I was marching down the street, one of the protesters was open carrying a huge assault rifle across the front of his body. It was something that I didn't even really see it until just the guy walked past me. And it was, you know, I'm not very familiar with guns outside of my professional requirements that I have to know about them to defend certain cases, but it was surprising to see. And what the Wauwatosa police had decided to do was allow those activities to occur. The Wauwatosa police were not shutting down these protests, even though the people were acting I think flagrantly unlawfully at the point that I left the protest, when they started shutting down North Avenue, setting up camp in the middle of the road so traffic couldn't get through. And Wauwatosa made the decision, the police department made the decision that we're not going to throw fuel on that fire. We're not going to arrest somebody who is carrying a firearm and committing a criminal act by shutting down a major thoroughfare in the community. And so, I think that's each police agency is looking at it and trying to decide how they should handle things.
And how did you feel being close to someone open carrying?
That's right around the time I got away from the group, because it just made things feel way too militaristic. The tension level just rose considerably when people started seeing that. And I'm sure the guy wasn't a felon. I mean, he's doing it so brazenly. I'm sure he's lawfully possessing a firearm, but any person with a basic level of common sense can see how quickly something like that can escalate. And the last thing I wanted to do is be anywhere near somebody marching down North Avenue with a rifle strung over his chest.
Right. And we have seen things obviously escalate is one word for it in Kenosha.
Yeah. And law enforcement's under the gun right now, as we're seeing, because the whole reason Kenosha is the epicenter is because of the shooting that took place, a few days prior to that. So law enforcement's got tough decisions to make here. Do they do what they probably want to do and think they should do, which is arrest people who are flagrantly violating curfew orders and out there causing havoc? I think every cop in that force, every officer in that force probably wants to arrest people and bring law and order to the community. But at the same time, will that escalate things further? And now I think, unfortunately, what we saw with this 17-year-old who committed this shooting, I don't think anybody expected that something like that was going to happen.
When it came to not just the 17-year-old, there were other people open carrying in Kenosha as well. And that's one thing. But where does the law stand when someone brandishes and uses open carry with the intent to protect property, even when it's not their property directly? So this shooter, he crossed state lines. Other people have traveled to Kenosha to take part in protests or to open carry and claim that they're there to protect property. But obviously, it's not their businesses. They don't live there. Where do things stand legally when it comes to this?
It's really, that's such a multifaceted question. I mean, so I think the best way to answer that is to say that Wisconsin law certainly permits a person to brandish a firearm to defend their property. So somebody starts coming to your business and they're going to torch it, or they're going to enter and they don't have permission to do so, you can certainly brandish a firearm to repel that behavior. You can use a firearm if you are suffering the risk of death or great bodily harm as a result of some aggressive action towards you. Defending property is a really tough call, though. I actually, about 15 minutes before our interview, I just fielded a call from a business owner in Kenosha who was asking me that exact question. Can I, myself and my friends or colleagues, can we use firearms or brandish firearms to defend property? And while you might lawfully be able to display a firearm in order to repel an attack against your property, again, that can escalate really quickly. And we're in a climate right now where it would not surprise me if the Kenosha District Attorney's Office, which has a reputation of being an aggressive prosecutor office, it would not surprise me if their position became, we're just going to prosecute anybody who discharges a firearm in these circumstances. We're going to start arresting everybody. We'll figure it out later, or we'll let a jury figure it out. Were you defending property or defending your life or fearful for your safety, or does the Castle Doctrine apply? I think their attitude is going to be, we need to stamp this down. We need to arrest anybody who's using firearms in any way. And I think that, they'll let it get sorted out down the road. So the advice really would be to anybody, honestly, the best advice from a criminal defense perspective, trying to avoid criminal charges, is get out of there. Lock yourself in your home. Property is property. Unfortunately, as awful as it is to see your business destroyed, you're better off being in your home. And if you want to possess a firearm, possess it in your home. And if somebody tries to come into your home, the Castle Doctrine allows you to shoot them if you want to.
When it comes to these outside groups coming, saying they're protecting other people's properties and businesses in Kenosha, while they think they're doing the right thing, does that hold any legal ground?
I mean, I think it's a harder argument to make to a jury down the road or a prosecutor's office that I came from another county to defend some other person's property. You're going to generate less sympathy from those who make decisions of whether or not to prosecute you, and jurors that may have to decide whether you're guilty or not guilty, than if you are the actual business owner standing at your doorstep warding off a mob. But I don't know that there's a legal analysis here. I think there's a practical analysis that sort of trumps the legal analysis.
These events bring together a lot of issues, but also a lot of legalities, a lot of people's rights into question. So how do people's First Amendment rights to protest coincide with or support Second Amendment rights?
Well, those are two very distinct concepts. So people, you know, the Bill of Rights wasn't, as far as I know, drafted in order of importance. In other words, I don't know that the First Amendment was first because it's more important than the Second Amendment. I haven't heard that argument. I think that, you know, you have the right to protest, but clearly government also has the right to impose reasonable restrictions on time, place, and circumstance to restrict people's First Amendment rights. And it's widely known that you can restrict people's First Amendment rights when circumstances warrant it, especially when there's violence and there's unruly mobs and things like that. Second Amendment rights, it's a similar concept. You do have an individual right to possess firearms, but of course that right is and has been tailored considerably over the years. And there's millions and millions of Americans who lawfully cannot possess firearms because government has decided, politicians have passed laws that, you know, if you've been convicted of disorderly conduct with your spouse, domestic violence crime, your gun rights are gone forever. You commit a felony, second offense, possession of marijuana in Wisconsin, you just became a felon, you lost your gun rights forever. So government has and can restrict each of those constitutional rights. The interplay between the two when you see the protests is really interesting because you do see people who are possessing firearms in the context of demonstrating peacefully. And I think that's why if you go back to the example I had of just here on North Avenue when I walked a few blocks with this group, that's exactly what I saw. The person possessing the firearm was a peaceful person. Nothing got looted, nothing got burned, no shots were fired. And Wauwatosa police were literally a few hundred feet down the road. As the protest would move a few feet, the Tosa police would move a few feet. I mean, so they just kept a distance and they monitored it. And I think the police behavior demonstrated a respect for people's rights to protest coupled with their rights to open carry firearms. I think law enforcement demonstrated considerable restraint, proper behavior, and they allowed those constitutional rights to be exercised, notwithstanding the law violations that eventually occurred.
Tony Cotton, thanks for helping us break down some of the basics here.
Thank you.
Tony Cotton is an attorney in Waukesha and the former president of the Wisconsin Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. We spoke with him in August after two protesters were killed in Kenosha. Coming up, we learn about Milwaukee's long history of protesting from historian John Gerda. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The protests that took place over the summer have drawn a lot of comparisons with the civil rights protests of the 1960s. Most notably, in 1967 through 1968, Milwaukee activists marched for 200 consecutive nights to protest the city's fair housing standards. But Milwaukee's relationship with protesting extends back much farther than the 1960s, to the city's foundation. And in some cases, these movements led to real systemic changes that speak to the very soul of the city. Historian John Gerda has written extensively about Milwaukee's past, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about how protest movements shaped the city.
So I think Milwaukee natives will be familiar with this kind of infamous story, but I think it really highlights how integral protesting and demonstrations of sorts are really a part of the fabric of this city. The Milwaukee Bridge War. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. The city was founded by three guys who didn't get along very well. You had Solomon Juneau on the east side, Byron Kilburn on the west side, and George Walker on the south side. And you have the first bridge built across the Milwaukee River back in 1840. And the West Siders suffered in silence for a while, but then one warm night in 1845, the West Siders took axes and hatchets to their side of the bridge, collapsed it into the Milwaukee River, and it floated downstream, kind of stately fashion, blocked traffic going north, and the East Siders wake up in the morning to find they can't get off out to the west, so they react by cutting off the West Side's bridges to the south. So for a while, no one could get anywhere. And you actually had, you know, there was not much of a police department back then. You actually had blood being shed for the greater honor or in glory of the East and West Sides, especially. The South Side was more non-combatant.
Well, and it seems like there's a period of time where Milwaukee was considered a bit lawless. You know, there was a lynching in the Third Ward. There was also a banking riot in the same year, 1861, so a couple decades after the Bridge War. Mm-hmm. How common were these kinds of uprisings at the founding of the city?
Relatively common, and it was by no means something that was unique to Milwaukee. You know, this was out in the frontier, and it wasn't quite, you know, shootouts at the OK Corral, but there was a kind of a rather impotent law enforcement system compared to what it became in later years. At one point, you have, you know, there were Irish, the Irish lynched an African-American, you know, who was involved in a knife fight with an Irishman. Around the same time, there were Germans, you know, who were rioting in the streets around the same period. And the police department was kind of powerless. They were outnumbered. That bank riot you're talking about back in 1861, you know, you have the sheriff, you have the mayor, they kind of came up, tried to soothe the crowd, and someone threw a brick, and you know, they realized they were outnumbered, so they beat a hasty retreat. So yes, it was, you know, it was a much wilder and woolier time than ours.
You know, we look even just a couple decades after that, we move into a part of our history that people are a little bit more familiar with and that bears a lot of resemblance to what we're seeing now. There were these labor protests in the city, which ultimately lead to a pretty grisly massacre. Tell us a bit about that moment in our city's history.
The year was 1886, and during those years in Milwaukee and nationally, if you worked in a factory, you were working at least 10 hours a day, often 12 hours a day, and you were working 6 days a week. So the weekends were one day long. It was Sunday. And there was no workers' compensation. There was no health insurance, no paid time off for anything. So it really was an extraordinarily severe system. So not surprisingly, labor organized early and often. And under the leadership of a national union called the Knights of Labor, Milwaukee and Chicago became the two main centers of agitation for the eight-hour day without a cut in pay. That was the primary cause they were after. And to make a long story short, there was a general strike that shut down the city on May 1st. There were crowds of protesters, strikers, marching around the city, closing other major employers. The last one open was the Bayview Rolling Mill on the southeast side. The morning of May 5th, a crowd of roughly 1,500 strikers, many of them Polish, marched from Mitchell Street, St. Stanislaus Church, and when they got to the mill, they found the militia waiting for them. And these were, in many cases, their neighbors and countrymen, kind of the early version of the National Guard. At a distance of roughly 200 yards, the militia opened fire, killing seven people, including a 13-year-old schoolboy who was playing hooky and a retired mill worker who was watching from his backyard. It was the bloodiest labor disturbance in Wisconsin's history and broke the back of the eight-hour movement, but at the same time really galvanized the working class to organize politically. They put together something called the People's Party in the very next election and swept the offices. And that was in many ways kind of a catalyst for the movement that we come to know as socialism, you know, which became the dominant party in 1910, you know, that landslide that put the first social administration into office in any American city.
Well, not long after that protest and those demonstrations, there was an event I found that seemed to have, again, a lot of parallels to things that we've seen today. It's mm-hmm. called the Smallpox Riot of 1894. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard about it before.
And it's been kind of buried, but it's a really interesting episode in Milwaukee's history. Back in those years, you know, there were contagious diseases of virulence and a variety that really overwhelm anything we're doing today, even the pandemic. You know, the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic pandemic was worse than COVID-19. So in some ways, we've kind of gone back to the way things had been earlier in Milwaukee's and the world's history. But smallpox, it was deadly. You know, there were vaccines for it, but there was an isolation hospital that was put on Milwaukee's south side, and that was considered a seat of pestilence by the neighbors. And you had a very autocratic health commissioner, a guy named Kempster, and they were actually taking infected kids out of their homes and taking them to the isolation hospital, which, as you can imagine, was just a red flag. But it was something that was kind of a low point of Milwaukee's public health experience, and things quickly got better. You know, during the 1918 epidemic, the Spanish flu, you know, Milwaukee was just a model of measures to fight and prevent the spread of that virus. We were among the healthiest cities in the country at that point.
Yeah. When we look at kind of where we are today, it's interesting to compare it to how we responded to the 1918 pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They did not say social distancing, but that's just what they were doing. You know, they closed the churches, the movie theaters, the legitimate theaters. So the result was, you know, that the rates of infection slowed here compared to other cities, especially out east. And they came back, this is the end of the last quarter of 1918. Just before Christmas, there was a resurgence of cases in November, so they had to put the restrictions in place again, and they were not lifted until December 25th. So, and even then, this is kind of reminiscent of, reminds us of what's going on now. New Year's Eve parties were held in December 31st of 1918, but if you were outside of the public dance, you had to wear six layers of gauze mask. So people were masked up in public then. And one newspaper reporter said that the dances looked like, from the neck up, people looked like they were holding up a bank. So it's a kind of a visual that is pretty familiar to us in 2020.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, we touched on the city's, I believe that the only known lynching of an African-American person in the city's history, which happened at a time when there really wasn't a large Black community in the area. But as we move into the 1940s, that starts to change with the Great Migration. Mm-hmm. And there were some growing pains. What did that look like?
Absolutely. There were fewer African-Americans in Milwaukee back in those years, but there was racism. You know, that's part of the legacy of slavery and just the treatment of African-Americans from the very beginning of their history in this country, way back in the early decades of the 1600s. After you have, you know, the Great Migration increases the number of African-Americans in Milwaukee from hundreds to thousands by 1950 or so. You know, you were up in a fairly appreciable size. At the same time, it was not until 1970 that Milwaukee was rose out of last place in its concentration or proportion of African Americans. So this was very much a recent phenomenon. So it was later, certainly, than it happened in Chicago, but the growth of the Black community, as you have in the north side, kind of moving north and west, they moved into the old German neighborhoods, and it was like oil and water. You know, so you have, there weren't race riots like there were in Chicago back in the 20s, but there certainly was a great deal of resistance and a great deal of flight, you know, in those years after, just after World War II, and a whole lot of unpleasantness, you know, just people being made to feel they were not welcome. And they had to live someplace. You know, you have this natural expansion as people came up here for jobs.
Well, and as we look into our history, I think people are going to be familiar with a lot of the protests of the 1960s, especially the Fair Housing marches. But mm-hmm. I was surprised to learn just how multifaceted the movements were at that time. What were some of the groups that were involved in protests at the time, and what were the different issues that they were hoping to change?
In terms of civil rights, the beginning there was school desegregation, and that's the time when they were called it intact busing. In the overcrowded schools in the Black community on the north side, they would bus whole busloads of kids out to classrooms in not full, you know, places that had place available in white neighborhoods, and then take them back at the end of the day because it was just open and shut racist. That was one issue. Another was the Eagles Club, which had a lot of judges among its membership, had a Caucasians only membership policy. Those protests took place in the, I think, 66, 67. And then open housing, you know, became the major kind of the flashpoint for a lot of the marches in Milwaukee for about 200 consecutive nights. And around the same time, you know, this really was, you know, it's when kind of when I came of age, you have the anti-war movement is going on at the same time. So the summer of 1967 was both the high point of the open housing marches and also the summer of love, where you have the beginnings of Beans and Lake Park happenings, as well as a lot of disturbances whose epicenter was the Water Tower Park, you know, right in front of what's now Columbia St. Mary's Hospital. And that was, it got fairly unpleasant. There was police intervention there as well. But people were marching because if you lost your college deferment or weren't in college in the first place, no, you were getting sent to Vietnam. So it was a war that was more and more unpopular and drew more and more protests as those years went on. So it really was, you talk about multifaceted, you know, it really was. That was just a wild summer. And that went on, you know, until the 1970 is when the campuses shut down. So until we pulled out in 1975.
As you mentioned, the anti-war movement continued on into the 70s. And the issues with racial inequity in the city of Milwaukee have continued really since 1960s. Mm-hmm. There have been protests, demonstrations in the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, you know, up until where we are right now. What mm-hmm. are some of the larger demonstrations that we've seen in our more recent history?
Boy, the Ernest Lacey was shot by the police. That's earlier, so there were protests there. Howard Fuller, the former school superintendent and educational activist, was the leader of that movement. You have in the 2016, you have the protests over the shooting of Sylville Smith. You know, that shooting led to unrest in Sherman Park, and in between, I can't think of flashpoints that would have been as dramatic as those.
There's one name that I might add, Dontre Hamilton. Did you say Dontre Hamilton?
No, I didn't. You're right. This is a repeating scenario. But I think the bottom line is that you have that conflagration in 1967 and martial law, Henry Meyer taking a firm hand that kind of put it down. The trouble was, and I think this is a national problem, was that when the violence ended, when it was quelled, there was a sense of victory, of order over chaos, rather than a wake-up call that something was seriously wrong and we had to address the problems that were deep-seated and had been around since the founding of the Republic. What seems different about the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020 is that there is a broader acknowledgement nationally, you know, that this is something that we've had in our system for a long time and we need to get rid of it.
John Gerda is the author of many books, including The Making of Milwaukee and Milwaukee City of Neighborhoods. He spoke to Lake Effect's Joy Powers in June. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
There's a man with a gun over there, telling my brothers they've got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. lines are being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds, taking so much resistance from behind. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the streets, singing songs and carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.